From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Eric Schwartz, president of Refugees International, and that's an independent humanitarian organization that advocates for better support for displaced and stateless people. And we're coming to you from Refugees International headquarters in Washington. Throughout his three-decade-long career, Eric Schwartz has focused on humanitarian and human rights issues. Under former President Barack Obama, he served as Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration. And under the Bill Clinton administration, Eric was the senior human rights and humanitarian official at the National Security Council, managing humanitarian responses to crises in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. He also served as the UN Deputy Special Envoy for Tsunami Recovery after the 2004 Asian tsunami. Some background first on Refugees International. It was started in 1979 as a citizens' movement to protect Indochinese refugees. Since then, it has expanded to become a leading advocacy organization that elicits action from global leaders to resolve refugee crises. RI does not accept government or UN funding, allowing its advocacy to be neutral and independent. We'll talk with Eric Schwartz about the challenges that face refugees around the world, particularly those fleeing the depredations of the Syrian conflict and the Rohingya, a Muslim minority group who has been persecuted in Myanmar, as well as the implications of changing U.S. policy toward refugees under the Trump administration. Eric Schwartz, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thanks again for hosting us here at your offices.
My pleasure.
Well, first off, Eric, there are many refugee assistance agencies around the world and here in the United States. What distinguishes Refugees International from the others?
I think that Refugees International actually has a unique identity in that we are an international humanitarian organization that focuses on the concerns of refugees and others displaced by persecution and conflict. But we are an international humanitarian organization that is focused exclusively on fact-finding, reporting, and advocacy. We don't run humanitarian programs, assistance programs. Our focus is on fact-finding, reporting, and advocacy. So in that sense, we're a humanitarian organization, but an unusual humanitarian organization. We're also an advocacy organization, but an advocacy organization for which our humanitarian mission is not part of a broader mandate. It is our exclusive focus. And so those elements make Refugees International, I believe, unique, combined with the fact that we don't take any funds from governments or international organizations. So a humanitarian fact-finding and advocacy organization that is wholly impartial and independent, that is what distinguishes Refugees International.
Well, based on your fact-finding, I'm assuming you have people in the field to collect
information. We have a team. Our team of researchers, the team is based in Washington and travels all over the world.
Based on that fact-finding, Eric Schwartz, how would you characterize the global refugee crisis? I've heard said that it's really the largest since World War II. And what groups of refugees worry you most?
It is. More than 65 million people displaced by persecution and conflict, more than 20 million of whom are refugees outside their countries of origin, and more than 40 million of whom are internally displaced persons who are displaced within their countries of origin. And those are the largest numbers in recorded history. And so the situation of refugees and forcibly displaced persons is quite dire. And what worries me the most, as fragile as the post-World War II international system was, and as imperfect as it was, as Kofi Annan said in 1999 in a very important speech before the General Assembly, that system has largely broken down. And the importance of strong governments in the world playing a leadership role in trying to resolve and address conflicts is very great. But we see, I think, a lack of real leadership from major governments of the world. on the issue of trying to resolve the very crises that give rise to refugee flight. And that worries me. It worries me a great deal. The governments of the world after World War II were never perfect at this effort, by any means. There were always millions of people who were forcibly displaced. But I'll be honest with you, you know, when the optimism, if you could use that term, that surrounded, you know, efforts to resolve crises in the 1990s, we don't really see that optimism today. Bosnia was a terrible tragedy, but it was a tragedy that ultimately came to some resolution. The situation in East Timor in 1999, a terrible tragedy, but governments of the world got together to address it. You know, we don't see that kind of collective effort today, and it makes me very nervous and very concerned and very sad when I think about some of the conflicts that have been so intractable and have resulted in such terrible loss of life.
Eric, to what do you attribute this? What are the factors you think are contributing to this apathy or lack of leadership with respect to the refugees?
You know, and I think there are several factors at play. I think the post-Cold War period, I don't mean to suggest that the Cold War period was in any way the halcyon days or a happy time in international politics, but the post-Cold War period has resulted in some diffusion of power in international politics. The United States was the absolute predominant world power coming out of the Cold War. I think relative power in international politics has been shifting in many respects, from west to east over time. And I think all of those changes create challenges in terms of global leadership and a collective willingness to address very difficult challenges.
Well, speaking of difficult challenges, let's look at the crisis with Rohingya. We know that more than 655,000 Rohingya have fled Western Myanmar, Rakhine State, since last August, when an attack on police posts by Rohingya insurgents catalyzed a brutal campaign of rape, murder, and arson by Myanmar's army and associated vigilantes. Hundreds of Rohingya villages were burnt to the ground. Now, the United States uses the term ethnic cleansing to describe the military's campaign against Rohingya. What is the status of the situation with Rohingya to date?
Well, the status is that nearly 700,000 Rohingya have been expelled from their country since August, and in what I regard as one of the most grotesque and unconscionable crimes of our generation. It's difficult to overstate the brutality of the actions of the Burmese military towards this beleaguered population. In a matter of weeks, literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were brutally chased out of their country. And the only way you can do that successfully, and successfully is a bad word to use, the only way you can do that is if you terrorize massively a population. And that's exactly what the Burmese military has done in actions that we, as early as September 5th, characterized as crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing. And what that meant was that troops would go into villages. They would launch incendiary devices. They would shoot people who were fleeing the villages. And they would, you know, raise the villages to the ground. I believe the number is nearly 300 villages were destroyed, if that number is correct. Estimates are that as many as 6,700 people were killed. We were in Bangladesh in September, and the stories were remarkably consistent and appallingly distressing. I struggle to find adjectives to adequately convey the depth of the depravity that was involved in this action by the Burmese military.
Many people are very disappointed in the de facto leader, Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, for not speaking out or doing more to stop these atrocities. To what extent do you think her lack of action has delayed more significant changes in relation to the Rohingya.
On the one hand, had she spoken out very strongly against these abuses and condemned them, she quite possibly would have done so at some personal risk. It feels a little bit presumptuous to suggest how far she should have gone in terms of protesting what happened. But of one thing I can be confident is that she didn't have to say things. She didn't have to make statements which created the appearance of her being an apologist for what happened. And a number of her statements created that impression. And I think that was very unfortunate and it was very unnecessary. She gave a speech in September in which she suggested that there wasn't discrimination against the Muslim community in education, in access to health care. She didn't have to do that, and she didn't have to play that role. I'd also say that were she prepared to stand up in September and condemn what was happening and say that this was a stain on the effort to promote a democratic future for her country, there's no question that that kind of statement would have changed the dynamic of the issue very quickly. Whether it would have carried the day, who knows? Whether it would have caused the military to change their tactics, I don't know. But there's no question that had she chosen to act in a very strong way, governments of the world would have had to have responded to her comments. But again, I think it's hard for us on the outside to dictate how far she should have gone. I do think it's appropriate for us to express some disappointment with respect to her statements that seem to put her in the role of an apologist.
Either way, Eric Schwartz, the problem with Rohingya in Myanmar, also known as Burma, are going to be a problem because we know that the predominantly Buddhist Burmese simply do not see the Rohingya as part and parcel of their culture or country, even though they have been there for generations. So how do you see going forward any attempts to reintegrate them? Is that even possible given the attitudes and policies toward them that still see them as strangers?
I'm not in this business if you're not prepared to be optimistic. Certainly to have that optimism guided by a sense of realism. But it's hard to know what the future will bring. I used the example of East Timor in 1999. East Timor is now an independent nation. Would anyone have imagined that East Timor was going to be an independent state? Not that I'm suggesting that the Rohingya would ever establish an independent state. That's not the purpose of this analogy. The analogy is that politics is very uncertain, and things that at one moment in time look like they could be completely unlikely and impossible to achieve, with the passage of time, become possible. And so I wouldn't rule out a political dispensation which would address the needs of the Rohingya people. And I also think that, look, this is a case of over many decades, the Rohingya in Burma have had their rights progressively reduced. That process can be reversed. And I think a critical element here is leadership. Yeah, people say that the people of Burma, of Myanmar, have this virulent hostility towards this Muslim population. But so much of that has been whipped up by the Burmese leadership. And leadership here and everywhere is of such critical importance. So I think governments of the world need to be talking very strongly and very sternly and being prepared to take serious and substantial measures against the Burmese military until there is progress towards a political dispensation that meets the rights and the needs of this population.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Eric Schwartz, president of Refugees International, and that's an independent humanitarian organization that advocates for better support for displaced and stateless people. And we're coming to you from Refugees International headquarters in Washington. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a Facebook fan, Nawab Behdad from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to Eric Schwartz, our special guest, and one quick follow-up with respect to Rohingya. before we turn to other areas, what about the strain that the Rohingya population, the refugees, are causing in Bangladesh, Malaysia, and elsewhere? How is that being managed, and is it going in the right direction?
Well, I think that, you know, refugees almost anywhere, you know, have a difficult time, and it's incumbent upon host governments to respect the principles of the Refugee Convention, which in the first instance mandate that nobody should be forcibly returned to a place where they would suffer persecution, but also demands that people receive refuge and that their rights be respected in countries of refuge. I think the critical issue right now is the one in Bangladesh. You're talking about one of the most densely populated countries in the world. I've traveled to the region, and it was just people were everywhere, occupying almost every visible space because of the influx of so many refugees. So it's a tremendous burden on the government. On the other hand, generally speaking, expressed its willingness to provide this population with refuge, and that is the appropriate thing to do. It's incumbent upon governments of the world to provide the government of Bangladesh with all the support that it requires. There have been troubling reports, this arrangement between the government of Bangladesh and the government of Myanmar. And I sometimes use these terms interchangeably, Myanmar and Burma, but there have been troubling reports about arrangements around repatriation of the Rohingya population. And any repatriation right now would be just so premature. The idea that you would deliver these people to their tormentors, to those who are responsible for these terrible crimes against this population, without absolute certain guarantees of the basic human rights of the Rohingya, guarantees of freedom of movement, guarantees relating to civil and political rights, some sense of guarantee of compensation for the lands that have been destroyed. None of that has been under any kind of serious discussion. So the idea that you would proceed with repatriation without those kinds of guarantees in place and some sort of process to monitor that those guarantees are actually being respected, the idea that you're going to move forward on that before all of that is in place is extremely troubling. I understand that the plans on repatriation have been put on hold, and they have to continue to be on hold until those kinds of guarantees are in place.
Do you think Bangladesh is getting sufficient support from...
No. No, they're not. No, the international appeals have been terribly underfunded, and it's just another example of the difference between rhetoric and reality. Governments of the world have expressed deep concern about the plight of the Rohingya. They've made expressions of solidarity to the government of Bangladesh. But you got to match that rhetoric with some real serious and substantial forms of assistance.
Where do you think that should come from?
I think it should come from all governments of the world. The United States has provided a significant amount of assistance. I think governments around the world should, especially governments with the wherewithal to do so, whether it's governments of Europe, the government of China, governments in the Arab world that have expressed
solidarity
with the plight of the Rohingya. When you're a humanitarian, you embrace the principle of humanity. And the principle of humanity fundamentally means that every individual, whether they're Muslim, Christian, Jew, whether they are white-skinned, dark-skinned, that we are all of the same inherent worth. And while I think expressions of solidarity are great, it shouldn't be the case that, you know, you have to turn to a Muslim government to get support from a Muslim population. You have to turn to a Christian government or a government in a country with a majority of Christians to get support for a Christian population. That's not the way this is supposed to work. But in any event, it is true that Arab governments have expressed solidarity to this population, and they need to increase their support as well.
Well, Eric Schwartz, even though it's not the way it's supposed to work, as you say, we're still seeing sort of a resurgence of discrimination against, for example, predominantly Muslim immigrants, refugees. An anti-immigrant wave is coming over Europe. We even have an anti-immigrant strain here in the United States. So that leads me to ask you, for example, about the Syrians, most of whom are Muslim, but not all, who are fleeing the conflict. What are your observations with regard to their absorption?
Resettlement of Syrians or any of the population, third country resettlement, in other words, a refugee population flees to a place of refuge, and then if they're going to move on, often it's through the process of third country resettlement where a decision is made by a government like the United States to say, okay, we will take some number of Syrian refugees from Jordan and we'll bring them into the United States. And under the best of circumstances, that kind of third country resettlement in countries like the United States and other countries largely in the global north, under the best of circumstances, that's not going to be the solution for a significant percentage of the world's refugees. It's just not. Having said that, even though it's not a solution for a large percentage of the world's refugees, it needs to be a solution for some number of the world's refugees, and for a number of reasons. First, because there are refugees who are in such vulnerable conditions that for them, third country resettlement is the right answer. Secondly, because governments in resettlement countries like the United States, like countries in Europe, they have to demonstrate to countries that are providing refuge to millions of refugees that they have a stake in this, that they have some, as we say in the United States, some skin in the game, that they're willing to come forward and make commitments, albeit modest ones, because third country resettlement is never going to be the solution for the majority of the world's refugees. But we have to demonstrate some solidarity with the governments that are hosting millions of refugees and commitment to being part of the solution. So for that reason, it's been a source of great concern and disappointment to me that the United States has so significantly reduced its refugee resettlement numbers and has imposed additional restrictions on this program. It's not good. It sends the wrong message internationally, and those policies and programs should be reversed.
Of course, you're speaking about the United States, and we know that the Trump administration has simply not shown the same type of policy perspective vis-a-vis refugees as the previous administration, perhaps because of this anti-immigrant rhetoric. It's hard to know.
There are several things about this administration's policies on refugee admissions and refugee resettlement that are disturbing, one of which is the administration has stoked unreasonable fears on the part of the American public. Since 9/11, we have resettled in the United States upwards of 1 million refugees. And since 9/11, there just hasn't been one case of a refugee resettled in the United States who was responsible for an act of terror that led to the loss of American lives. It just hasn't happened. So the rhetoric of fear, you know, has created a misperception about threats that refugees pose, and it's also, frankly, created a misunderstanding and a misperception about the contributions that not only refugees but all immigrants have made to American society. And I think that is pernicious, it's dangerous, it's unfortunate, and it needs to be opposed by fair-minded people who stand for values that really kind of inform the founding of our nation, of the United States.
Well, in contrast, we know, of course, Germany has taken in hundreds of thousands of refugees, primarily from Syria, but not only. And even the new coalition agreement will allow more refugees to enter Germany each year, many more times the number that President Trump has set for the United States. But still, Europe suffers divisions. They're facing a deadline in June about how to share the migrant burden. How optimistic are you that the Europeans can come to an agreement? Because we know some of the Eastern European countries are balking at taking a certain number of refugees, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and they're going to be reaching an inflection point soon.
Look, it is definitely the case. There is an important discussion and debate going on in Europe, and I think it really is a debate for the kind of, if you will, for the heart of the continent. I'm hopeful that principles of inclusion, of respect for diversity, of an appreciation that diversity can strengthen a society, that those perspectives will prevail. It's clear that in order to sustain public support for generous policies of immigration and refugee resettlement, you have to demonstrate as a government a capacity to manage your borders. And I think when people fear that the process is completely uncontrolled, then that perception can give rise to perspectives that are more chauvinistic and more inclined to basically say, let's just keep people out. So governments have important responsibilities with respect to migration management, but they also can't let those responsibilities come at the expense of continued willingness to provide refuge and to promote diversity and inclusion in their societies. I think there's an important discussion and debate going on in Europe and around the world. I think the debate in Europe would be a lot more focused toward the objectives of inclusion if there was a different kind of expressions coming from the United States and the U.S. leadership. I think when the U.S. president is articulating anti-immigrant perspectives that are very negative about refugee resettlement, I think that sends a very unfortunate signal not only to Europe and to European leaders, but it also has an enabling effect. And it makes it easier for demagogues to spew the kind of vitriol which doesn't help the situation one bit.
Well, Eric Schwartz, of course, migration happens all the time for economic and political reasons, reasons of conflict. But we probably could reduce the flow of refugees if we could address the roots of the problem. So that's the other side of the coin that I wanted to ask you. It's all well and good for countries to be compassionate, but there are limits. And so what about trying to address the root causes of refugee flows so that we could try to nip them in the bud? I mean, for example, the conflict in Syria, many people say perhaps it could have been averted. It's easy, you know, in retrospect. The Rohingya situation, if there was not a crackdown by the Burmese military. To what extent does your organization, Refugees International, lobby or try to solve the problems before they begin, or try to at least look at that other side of the equation, not only accommodate the refugees, but try to address the political problems that have given rise to these refugee flows to begin with, whether the Syrian conflict or in Myanmar?
The former UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Sadako Ogata, was famous for saying that humanitarian problems don't have humanitarian solutions. And that's obviously the case. They have political solutions. And those solutions have to do with, as you put it, I think, root causes, how to deal with the root causes of conflict. Because so much of what we deal with are people who are fleeing conflict and persecution. So dealing with root causes is critical. There are kind of two ways you can deal with root causes. You can deal with root causes over the long term through smart development processes, both economic development, but also political institution building and the like. And that's really the focus of the development community. But in addition, there are what the Carnegie Commission on the Prevention of Deadly Violence 20 or so years ago called operational prevention. I think that's what they called it, which is, you know, conflict resolution efforts when conflict appears imminent, and how to deal with either pre-conflict situations or situations that are involving conflict where the international community or governments of the world can play a role in ameliorating conflict. The tools for that are conflict mediation, peacekeeping, and measures designed to ward off or stem imminent conflict. And we are, Refugees International is very concerned about this. We support, for example, generous funding for United Nations peacekeeping and increased capacity for UN peacekeeping. So all of those efforts are really critical. But having said that, I don't see a time in the future where there will be no victims of conflict and persecution who are fleeing borders. And that being the case, I think the international governments of the world also have to think about solutions for refugees who may never get to go back. And there, the international community, governments of the world, are talking about some interesting ideas, like providing refugees with real opportunities to work, providing refugees with real opportunities to obtain education, to give them some sense of status in the countries to which they have fled, even if it doesn't mean granting them full citizenship. The conversation about that objective has become a more serious one, and there have been programs. The World Bank has gotten very involved in some of these programs. And I think that in the midst of all this terrible suffering, in the midst of all that, I think these are some hopeful signs.
Eric Schwartz is president of Refugees International. Eric, thank you so much for your time and for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our audio and video engineer was Ted Schneider. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.